the Total Soccer Show Weekend Review. Man United and Liverpool shared a 2-2 score, which saw the title race tighten even more. Just 1 point now separates the top three. It's going to be a great run-in, I think you'll agree. Outside the Prem, it was derbies galore, with local rivalries taking the floor, like the one in Glasgow that was hotter than arson, and the game in LA, won by the team from Carson. And of course, there was the game won by the Giallorossi, making a huge win for their leader, Daniel De Rossi. Elsewhere, we had the final of the Copa del Rey, which was won by the team that thinks Basque players are bae. And in Germany, Bayern Munich's implosion was afoot, and the Bundesliga title race is truly kaput. My name is Ryan Bailey. I'm back, everybody, joining me today. Joe Lowry, did you enjoy my use of the word bae there? You looked like you did.
That was so good, Ryan. I hate that it actually worked in the rhyme. That is well done on your part.
Thanks, Joe. Also joining us, Graham Ruslan. Morning, Graham. Hello, Graham. Afternoon, evening, Graham. Whatever time of day I'm talking to you, Graham.
Hello, Ryan Bailey. I'm not entirely sure myself what time of day it is inside the Pillow Fort. You said before we started recording that there was a line in your intro that would make Joe cringe. Mm-hmm. You were incorrect about that. It made me cringe as well. I guess applause to you. You're truly back.
I was just expecting a should have scored or something along those lines. And then when it was like, slang that you missed by about 15 years, Ryan, or just a few years, depending on how you look at it, that somehow didn't hurt me quite as much. But Ryan, it is great to have you back. We hope you enjoyed your lovely time off. It's good to see your wonderful face.
What were you doing, by the way? Were you like raiding the port of Tortuga? Or I'm not entirely clear what you were doing on the high seas.
I think it was that, Graham. I'm pretty sure that's what it was.
Me? No, I wasn't on vacation. I was just doing charity work. I just do charity work. I keep it quiet for about a week every year, sure. Graham. Taylor Rocco not with us. He's on a luxury Bahaman cruise right now. That old salty sea dog, by the way. It's one in, one out policy we have here on Total Soccer Show. Taylor's on his one-day cruise. He'll be back on the feed very shortly, though, of course. Bonus content from TSS at patreon.com/Total Soccer Show if you would like to support us. We've got plenty coming on the feed this week, including a little weekend review extra. There's so much weekend, Graham. We have to do a little overflow into the Patreon feed. We're going to be talking about the Turkish Super Cup and the madness therein, the Portuguese title race, and much, much more. Graham, that look on your face, you can hardly wait, right?
There's just so much mayhem, Ryan, right now, that we cannot fit it in to an hour-long episode, especially if Taylor's not hosting. So, it's getting pushed onto the Patreon this week, so come and join us over there and listen to all that good stuff.
Yes, indeed. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show, please and thank you. Let's get to the main meat of the weekend review, though, shall we? We turn our attention to the Premier League. Manchester United 2, Liverpool 2 being the headline game of the weekend. The first of the title-chasing pack has faltered, Joe, it appears, with Liverpool dropping points in this one. The consensus, Joe, I think, was that United maybe, you know, deserved a draw for the second half performance, but Liverpool have got themselves to blame for not winning it in the first half. Maybe not the mentality monsters of the weekend. We might get to them shortly in the Premier League, Joe. But a decent game that either could have won, right?
Yeah, I love this game. As a neutral, I thought this was absolutely fantastic. Liverpool may have just bottled their title all in one moment in the 50th minute of this game, which I'm sure we'll get to shortly. This, for me, was a reminder of why this sport can be so fun. Liverpool dominated Manchester United in the first half. 15 shots to zero. 35 minutes into this game, it was 12 shots to zero. Liverpool had all of the chances. Man United offered basically nothing. And yet, guys, the game was not over. Like, this is oftentimes the ultimate underdog sport because Liverpool did everything, but finally, like, stomped Manchester United to the ground in the first half. They created chances. They'd scored a goal from Luis Diaz off of a really nice corner kick routine, headed flick from Darwin Nunez towards the back post. Diaz volleys it out of the air into the ground and into the back of the net. And it just felt like everything was going Liverpool's way, right? Last weekend, we have the draw between Man City and Arsenal that wasn't pretty, but it was a beautiful sight for Liverpool because it put them on top of the title race. And now, in one moment from Bruno Fernandes and one really, really poor mistake from Kwanzaa, all of a sudden, Manchester United are back in this game. They didn't deserve to be. It took a lot of fortune for Man United to actually like find themselves on the same field as Liverpool in the second half. But did it make this game spicy? Absolutely, it did.
Yeah. Graham, why are Man United such a hurdle for Liverpool to get over time and time again?
They're such a weird team, Manchester United. Liverpool, as you say, Joe, might well look back on this match with regret at the end of the season if they narrowly miss out on the title. So are you calling it? You think they've blown their title chance at this point? Because obviously it's still so tight.
It's not over, but this was a winnable game and a really, really sharp performance for 49 minutes of this match that felt like Liverpool were going to continue to push forward towards the title, and all of a sudden, one moment pulls the rug out from under them. So I think they are not likely to win the title at this point, and 3 points would have changed that a ton for them.
Yeah, I mean, given the way that this match pans out, the stuff that you mentioned, Joe, particularly in the first half, where Manchester United's XG at halftime was zero. They didn't have a single shot in this game. Liverpool had all the opportunities. They were cutting through Manchester United at will. So for them to not win this game, on the back of that FA Cup game a couple of weeks ago, which was another complete chaos match between these two teams. So Liverpool had a warning of how these games can get away with from you at Old Trafford, despite the Manchester United's flaws. But it was almost like Liverpool didn't know what to do, how to handle the way that Manchester United were playing. What I mean by that is, this is not the way that top level teams play in the modern era. I heard someone say it's like a boxer refusing to throw any punches or defend, and the other guy thinking, like, so what, am I just meant to like punch you over and over again? I've given up trying to work out Manchester United because I was driving myself crazy trying to do that a few weeks ago. Instead, I am just enjoying the madness. Every single one of their matches is must watch at the moment. Of course, last week, they were leading 3-2 against Chelsea in the 97th minute and somehow contrived to lose that game. So every single one of Manchester United's matches is complete madness. I've given up trying to work it out. But obviously on the balance of the statistics of the chances, Liverpool, 9 times out of 10, end up winning this match. And it could prove costly that they didn't in this 10 out of 10 match.
Well, do you think it will be costly, Graham? As we mentioned, there's a point between the top three at the moment. Liverpool in second on 71 points behind Arsenal on goal difference. It's still anyone's game. If we look at the run-ins, I don't know. This could be the one that they cite when they do not win the league, but it also is anyone's game. I don't know. I'm asking you, Graham.
Potentially, this could be a big moment in their season. I just think there's been so many twists and turns over the course of the season, and each of these teams have flaws. At this point, I would actually say Arsenal look like the most flawless team, if that makes any sense, if you can work that sentence out, just because of their defensive record, and we'll talk a little bit about them later on. But Man City have flaws. Liverpool clearly have flaws. Some of that was exposed in this game. I thought Manchester United, the way that Ten Hag has set up Man United in the last two matches against Liverpool has largely been to play on the break, and that is probably the right decision because they just don't have the ability or intelligence to play an intricate passing game like a lot of their rivals do. You look at the players that Man United have in that attack, Rashford, Fernandes, Garnacho, even Hoyland. They are suited to breaking into space at speed, and that gave Liverpool issues. We've seen in this match and other games this season for Liverpool that you can get at them in quick transition and on the break, and that's what Manchester United did in this game. Now, this isn't what Ten Hag was appointed to implement as Manchester City manager. He's had to vary so dramatically from what he knows best. And even in matches like this one where Man United get a positive result, it's an emergency measure, right? This is not the long-term plan for Manchester United. But every so often, there is a game where they are allowed to play to their strengths in parts of the matches. They can't produce a 90-minute performance. And in the second half, the way that the momentum swung with that Bruno Fernandes goal, which, by the way, is so well taken Fernandes, the way that he cuts across it, it's like a golf shot from about 40 yards out. And football is a stupid sport. And in that moment, the momentum switches and all of a sudden it's Manchester United that are cutting through Liverpool. Of course, the Kobbie Mainoo goal, which had big Federico Makeda vibes. I don't know if that was slightly before your time, Joe, but it's almost an identical goal. Look it up. It's an incredible goal. It's almost exactly the same. I thought Kobbie Mainoo in general was very, very impressive. So it was a weird match where Liverpool were in control for large periods of it. They had loads of chances, but even still, Manchester United were suited to expose some of the weaknesses that Liverpool do have in defensive transition.
Joe, if we're going to look at the title race once again, if I'm a neutral, I am a neutral, I don't have a dog in this fight at all. Is there a case for Liverpool being the team that the neutral should back, just for the way they play, just for the way they do allow space for the opposition? They're a bit more swashbuckling than Arsenal and Man City.
Well, after the City-Arsenal game last week, I'm backing Liverpool for the title.
Exactly. I mean, that should be good enough reason for the neutral packs to back Liverpool, Joe. But what do you think? In terms of the way they play, should it be Liverpool that the neutral kind of gets behind?
I mean, in terms of the aesthetics, I think there's a lot to that, Ryan. We see the 4-3-3 shape from Liverpool in this game. It's a lot of the same stuff for Jurgen Klopp, regardless of the match. They're going to engage high up the field. They're going to press. Manchester United, especially in the first half, had a ton of problems trying to work their way through Liverpool's press. They couldn't really find a way through on the ground in either their sort of base 4-2-3-1 look or in possession in more sustained sequences, where they didn't have very many in this game, regardless of the half. We did see Diego Dalo shift from right back into central midfield, and we saw more of a 3-2-5 with Dalo and Casemiro as that double pivot. Kobbie Mainoo would shift forward. You'd have Bruno Fernandes in the other half space, and the wingers would stay pretty wide, or Wan-Bissaka on one side would push high or stay deeper from his left-sided center-back spot. Like, Liverpool pressed the living daylights out of Manchester United for a lot of this game. And when Man United couldn't find a way through, they tried to go over to Rasmus Højlund, which wasn't especially effective either. Then you look on the other side, Ryan, if we're talking about the neutral's perspective, it feels like there is, with Liverpool, maybe more than with Arsenal because of their defensive solidity that Graham talked about, that I talked about in The Big Thing a couple of weeks ago, Manchester City with their hyper-fixation on controlling the ball and controlling the field. With Liverpool, it feels like there is this twist of chaos that doesn't just come because of their tactics, but also comes because of who's playing for them right now. Kwanzaa, 21-year-old center back, not the first choice option. We're looking at Bradley at the right side of the back line. You've got some younger options coming off the bench in central midfield. This team is still struggling with injuries. You're looking at Kelleher in goal as well. Like, this is not Liverpool at their peak, frankly, and we saw that in this game. It was one moment from a young player in the middle of the back line that completely turns this game around. So yeah, I think if you're a neutral wanting to watch some of the most entertaining games, now Arsenal and Man City both put up 3+ goals this weekend as well, so there was plenty of action for those squads too, but Liverpool have the right balance of actually being very, very good at soccer, but still having the almost feeling of impending doom that seems to follow them.
Liverpool also have a front three, who, by the way, I love watching Liverpool's front three. Diaz, I thought, was arguably the best player on the pitch here. He's always on the move. He is so good at contorting his body to get on the end of chances. I know it's a different position, but he reminds me of Luis Suarez in that way. They both have that same sort of quality. As I think I've described on this show previously, I'm a massive fan of Darwin Nunez. But that front three, everything that Liverpool do is geared towards getting that front three into as many goal-scoring opportunities and high-value areas as possible. But two of those three players, how would you say, are not particularly concise in their output. There is quite wide variance in their conversion rate game to game. And the two players I'm talking about are Diaz and Darwin Nunez. And Mohamed Salah, since coming back from injury after AFCON, has also kind of joined those ranks where his finishing has not been as sharp. I saw The Athletic did a graph of Salah's finishing over the last few games, and it has dipped quite dramatically. Now, he's having lots of shots and lots of chances, and Manchester United helped him in that regard with the space that they gave him. But nonetheless, he's not quite as sharp in his finishing. So that's maybe the thing that could let Liverpool down in this title race. And I still have faith that Diaz, and particularly Darwin Nunez, will round out as a player over the course of their career. But right now, with, what is it, 7 games before the end of the season, that might end up being a factor for Liverpool.
Wow. Graham, I've just Googled Federico Macheda, by the way, who is 32 years old. I had him down to be about 50 at this point.
Yeah, that's not as old as I thought he would be. Is he still playing? I've no idea where he is.
He's at Apoel in Greece. There you go.
I'm beginning to think this goal wasn't before my time. I just had never heard of it. Can we talk very quickly about another goal, though? The Kobbie Mainoo goal in this game was absolutely absurd. In almost any other match, I think this would have been like the thing that we lead with. But that Bruno Fernandes first-time strike, I think it's further than 40 yards, Grim. It's inside the center circle. It's a banger from Bruno Fernandes. There's no doubt about that. But the Mainoo finish is absolutely unreal. To turn and sort of cushion the ball and then curl it towards the top right corner, at least that far right side of the goal, from a really, really difficult angle. It's not a finish that we see repeated all that often. It's not one that we're going to see from Mainoo next week or the week after. That's part of what makes it so special. But his quality, his ability to stride forward into the box and to influence games is real. Even if this isn't the sort of finish that is super repeatable, man, this thing was so, so nice.
Well, Joe, you say it isn't repeatable, but he's kind of already scored a goal that's similar to this, away to Wolves, where he scored pretty late on to win a game. So I take your point. He's not going to do this in every game. He'll only do this at most a handful of times in a season. But I'm just so impressed with Kobbie Mainoo, even in the way that he scores that goal. Obviously, it's an incredible finish, but impressed by the way that he conducts the whole move himself. He feeds the ball out wide, he waves Garnacho away, and then takes it back and has a clear vision of what he wants to do. He is a tremendous talent, and this was another match where I ended up marvelling at how the only player with any composure in that Man United team is the 18-year-old who's only played a handful of senior matches. He's just very, very impressive.
Yeah, he's not been exposed to the ways and machinations of Man United yet, Graham.
He's not been dragged down yet.
Yeah, exactly.
That'll come.
Does he get on the plane though, Graham, for this summer? That's the question.
Oh, absolutely. I think the question is whether he's starting for England. He started the last friendly, right, in the last window. That, to me, was Southgate road testing that. That's the question with Manu, is whether he starts, not whether he gets on the plane.
Oh, so many options for the Three Lions this summer. Wonderful stuff. Why don't we turn our attention to Man City, who had a potentially tricky trip to Crystal Palace. Graham, I think Pep Guardiola was even suggested in his pre-match press conference that this one could be the stumbling block for Man City. But a 4-2 win at Selhurst Park, a comeback win with De Bruyne getting his 100th goal for Man City in this one.
And what a goal the equaliser was. Absolutely sensational. Pep blew him a kiss after it as he was celebrating on the touchline, which was heartwarming, although I bet he berated De Bruyne down the tunnel for not tracking a runner or something, because that's what Pep Guardiola does. A bit of rotation from City in this game, so Phil Foden scored a hat-trick against Aston Villa during the week, so naturally he was benched for this one. Great for my fantasy team. Of course, City have Real Madrid in the Champions League this week, so that was probably definitely a factor there. Oscar Bob got the start on the right, still the best name in the Premier League. Jack Grealish was on the left, and I was impressed by Jack Grealish. He hasn't had the best of seasons, but this was a reminder of what he can offer City. He is a different player to Doku, who is someone who wants to drive at defenders, and I suspect that Doku maybe starts that Real Madrid game, given the weakness that Real Madrid have in defensive transition, and putting him up against Dani Carvajal seems like a pretty good idea. But Grealish, he allows City to build pressure, to retain possession and play the passing triangles and build up that way. He played a role in all four City goals, and Guardiola does this thing where other managers kind of rotate game to game. Guardiola does this thing where he gets big long stretches out of players over the course of the season. So for a couple months it'll be Phil Foden, for a couple months it'll be Bernardo Silva, for a couple months it'll be Jack Grealish. And I kind of wonder if Jack Grealish will have a stretch now between now and the end of the season. This was much better from him.
Wonderful stuff. Joe, anything on Man City? Stephen Ortega maybe?
Yeah, two quick things. I'll get to the Ortega bit in just a second. One of the things that impresses me about City as a unit, and it's one of the things that I think sets them apart even compared to other possession teams that do a really, really good job of holding the ball and creating chances, they don't ever seem to really get rattled in their possession structure. They don't seem to get super rushed. In this game, they concede just 3 minutes in, and you can see how irritated Pep is about that, conceding another goal from a counterattack, which is basically the only way that Man City are going to concede goals at this point in 2024. But Mateta makes a really nice run on the counter and scores with a clever right-footed finish, and City are down 1-0. They don't really seem fazed. Like, the objective in that moment for City stays the same. And I think that's maybe the thing that sets them apart. Either way, they needed a goal. Either way, they were looking for a goal. So they don't feel the pressure to go and really overhaul what they were doing. Also, the opposition's defensive structure doesn't really change either. Palace were already sitting so incredibly deep in this game. So the objectives for City from minute one to minute four in this game, where the scoreline changed, didn't actually change all that much. And I think that does really help City set themselves apart. De Bruyne gets a banger to put Man City back in this game. Then there's obviously a bunch of other goals as well. The Ortega sequence is absolutely unbelievable. I don't know if you guys saw this or not. I don't know if the internet saw this, because it didn't go viral enough on my timeline, which means at least I'm following the wrong people. I'm not sure what it is. Stefan Ortega, playing a goal for Manchester City, pulls off maybe the best piece of close control I've ever seen from a goalkeeper. I'll set the scene. 42nd minute. Crystal Palace are forward, which is a rare instance. They actually have the ball a bit in the final third. And Rodri ends up in possession just inside City's own box. You feel pretty comfortable about Rodri being on the ball. Not in this case, apparently, because he plays a back pass to Stefan Ortega, which is normally fine. Like, City usually play through the goalkeeper. That's all fine. Except Rodri clearly doesn't see Mateta to the left of Ortega. And so as the ball is rolling back towards the goalkeeper, Mateta makes a break on it, because of course he does. This is almost a free goal for him. Ortega, though, is aware enough to step forward. He sort of feints towards the ball, knowing he has to control it or City are about to go down 2-1. And he does it with a silky smooth right-footed chop, like behind his left leg. And then he flows right from the right-footed chop into a left-footed, like, diagonal. It is amazing. I don't think I've ever seen a goalkeeper with quite this much calm in this moment. It's so good.
Joe, I think it's the most Pep Guardiola thing ever to have a goalkeeper do a Cruyff turn in a pressure situation.
The thing that's so brilliant about it, I don't know if you guys caught the replay, but it's the little roll over the ball with the foot behind his standing foot. It's not just like a flick. He rolls it over to get it out to the other side of his body. It's just an incredible piece of skill.
I'm in love.
I'd love to think that was a training ground thing. I would love to think that, but maybe it wasn't. Well, I guess the question is whether he plays against Real Madrid this week as well, right? He's certainly earned his colours with that one, we should say. Anyway, let's go to Arsenal's 3-0 win over Brighton as well. Saka, Havertz and toss up with the goals to put Arsenal top of the league, where they stay on goal difference. Graham, they've only dropped 2 points in since this start of this year, and that was to Manchester City last week. Are they the new mentality monsters? Have they taken the title?
They haven't taken the title yet, clearly, as the table shows. But I am, and look, this was a curse for me last season, where I'm pretty sure at the point that I said I was considering Arsenal as the title favourites, they completely collapsed. So I'm trying not to curse your team, Arsenal fans. But this weekend, with Liverpool dropping points, was maybe the point I've started to look at Arsenal as the strongest team of the three. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to win the title, but this was really impressive by Arsenal, because this match against Brighton, this 3-0 win, because this had the potential to be a banana skin. Brighton haven't quite been as good as I thought they were going to be earlier in the season, when I thought they were going to be in kind of top four contention. They've faded away since then, but still, they are clearly a well-coached team with a lot of talent, and they were made to look ordinary by an even better coach team with more talent. Saka coming back from injury gave Arsenal that outlet on the right side that is so important to the way that they play, with the number of times that they feed him and get him against one-on-one. I don't think it was Saka's best game, but he scores the first goal and now has 30 goal involvements for the season. Saka did say something after the match, which was a little bit concerning, where he said he wasn't ready to start, but he's been out with an injury, is the context. But Arteta sort of insisted. I'm paraphrasing there, but that was the gist of what he said. Arsenal better not do a Pedri here. I'll let them off because they are chasing a title, but they probably need to chill out a little bit with how much they demand from Bukayo Saka and how much he plays for them. But yeah, having him back is obviously a boost. Once again, I thought we saw the importance of Havertz to this Arsenal team, with his runs through the middle, stretching the pitch. His movement is really clever. Look at the sort of double movement for the second Arsenal goal. That's where the space comes from, is from him kind of checking back for that. But the big storyline with Arsenal right now, despite the fact they score 3 goals in this game, is their defence. It's kind of wild that a team with their attacking talent, coached by a Pep disciple, is marching towards the title with a defensive strength of a peak Mourinho Chelsea team. But that's what we're seeing at the moment. And if they're going to win the title, that'll be the thing that gets them over the line. They now have 7 clean sheets in 11 Premier League games this year. They've not conceded a goal in any of their last 5 away games. Brighton did ask questions of Arsenal at the back. They looked to be targeting Zinchenko with direct balls. Lamptey is a runner who likes to get forward as well. They bent a few times. Brighton did have opportunities, but Arsenal never broke. So even when they're under pressure in games like this, it always feels like they have a degree of control. And that is maybe the thing, when I contrast them to even City, as strong as they are, and certainly Liverpool, that might be the thing that gives them the advantage.
Arsenal didn't break in this game. I almost broke on the commentary feed, and this is a reminder of why I watch games on mute. It is early in this match from Arsenal. Bukayo Saka is driving down the right side, and he cuts inside onto his left foot and tries to find the back post from like 10 yards out with 3 bodies in his way. And the very first thing that the color guy says, and I don't know who this was, so I can't properly toss this out, he's got to score there.
And Joe, I know exactly the chance you're talking about. That's ridiculous.
Guys, I cannot express to you my rage internally. I was so angry. I was like, okay, is this right for me to be watching the rest of this game? And it hurt, guys. It really hurt me. Ryan, are you gonna let them hurt me like that?
I would never let them hurt you like that,
okay.
Joe.
I'll time to take word. Action then, pal.
Yeah. All right. I'm on it. Don't worry. Don't worry, Joe. In terms of the run-in though, Joe, with Arsenal, looking at what they've got a North London derby coming up. They've got a trip to Old Trafford. Last game of the season is against Everton, who might really need some points in that last game of the season. Toughest running, potentially.
Well, it doesn't matter with Everton. The Premier League will just deduct them anyway.
Well, they won't add them on for Arsenal, I suppose, is the problem there.
No.
Joe, what do you think about their running? It's tricky.
They absolutely have difficult games, and they've still got 2 legs against Bayern Munich in the Champions League. And we'll talk more about Bayern Munich later. That may or may not be a difficult series. We will find out shortly. But there are obviously still plenty of games on the calendar for them. Chelsea are this team that I mean, what are we even supposed to do with Chelsea, guys? This has been the problem this entire season. We're coming off of that absolutely absurd, what was that, Thursday game between Man United and Chelsea, where Chelsea come back. And it is, I mean, it was just pure comedy, to be honest, from a Manchester United standpoint. But I bring that game up to say, even that one, where there's a noticeable gap in the table, it's not going to be an easy game for Arsenal. I would still go with my original big thing prediction of Manchester City going out there and doing this thing. If Liverpool had taken care of business this weekend, I might have a different story for you. Arsenal, I think with a couple of difficult games in the Champions League and some difficult, like really, really difficult games in the Premier League, it's hard to feel great about them. It's easy to feel good, but it's hard to feel great about them.
All right, time for a quick break. When we come back, a little bit more Premier League. We've got the Copa del Rey final. We've got the Bundesliga, a bunch of derbies, much more coming shortly.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public, the other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy, it's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our weekend review. A couple more results from the Premier League to go through. How about Tottenham with a 3-1 win over Nottingham Forest, Graham? Van de Ven with a very nice goal in this one, putting Spurs in the top four for the first time in a long time, ahead of Aston Villa on goal difference.
Yeah, an important win for Spurs for that reason. Ryan into the top four, that's where they hope to stay. Of course, top five might be enough to qualify for the Champions League from the Premier League this season, but top four makes it certain. Nottingham Forest pose a real threat in this match. They are a good counter-attacking team, or a decent counter-attacking team, and they had a goal disallowed that would have put them 1-0 up. They were having joy playing through Spurs in the middle of the pitch, and Chris Wood equalised to make it 1-1 after some good work from Anthony Elanga down the right side. Wood also missed this. I don't know if either of you caught this. The chance that he missed, he absolutely smashes a shot off the post so hard from close range that it wouldn't have surprised me if the woodwork had snapped in half. And it was really bizarre the way he takes that. It's like he thought, screw it, when a bit more of a tactile shot probably goes in, and that was when the game was at 1-1, so that could have been an important moment in the match, but he misses it. And then Big Ange changed his midfield at halftime. Bentancur and Højbjerg came on at halftime. That made a big difference. They took control of the middle. The Forest counters weren't quite so potent, and Bentancur, who I think is an incredible midfielder, we really haven't seen the best of him for Spurs yet, largely due to injuries more than anything else, but he helps create the third goal with a nice flick into Pedro Porro, who finishes. Timo Werner, Ryan, was excellent again. He created the first goal. He gives Spurs that verticality on the left that Postecoglou wants. His pace caused problems throughout. He came off to a standing ovation. So Ryan, are you going to give Turbo Timo his flowers, or put some respect on his name? You're not,
so,
are you?
From what you've just said, he didn't last the full 90 and didn't score. Is that what you said?
Sorry, I'm just still stuck on Turbo Timo, which is absolutely incredible.
He was good. He was good. Genuinely. They should pay. I think the release clause is 15 million, or the buy option is 15 million. So Spurs should definitely sign him permanently, if only to annoy Ryan Bailey, who will have to talk about him every day he's in the Premier League.
I'm actually, Ryan, aligned with your agenda on this, because there are reports out there that the New York Red Bulls are interested in acquiring Timo Werner if things sort of take a turn for the worse over in Tottenham. So if Timo could stop having good performances, that would probably be better for my game, personally.
This is an anti-Lewis Morgan agenda, is what this
is. Well, yeah, there is some of that. It's more of an anti-Scotland thing, which you should know well.
Indeed. Villa with a 3-3 draw against Brentford. Graham, Ollie Watkins rescuing a late point for Villa after they surrendered a 2-goal lead in this one. They are just behind Spurs on goal difference, as we noted.
Yeah, Villa down to fifth place. I think they'll be fine for the Champions League for the reasons that I just mentioned with Spurs. Fifth place is probably going to get you into the Champions League, and I don't see Manchester United the way that they're playing at the moment. Catching Aston Villa, it's quite a big gap. But the main storyline from this game is nothing actually to do with Aston Villa, or at least not from an attacking point of view, certainly from a defensive point of view. 3 goals in 9 minutes Brentford scored in this game. The defending from Villa in that 9-minute period was abysmal. The space that Brentford were able to find smack bang in the middle of the box to get on the end of crosses a couple times at least, certainly with the Mbeumo goal, there's two players around him and just don't engage with him at all. It was pretty shambolic from a Villa point of view. I think some of it comes from how much time and space Brentford had in the wide areas to get those crosses in, and that comes back to the weakness I've spoken about with Villa all season, the fullbacks. That's the one area where they could really afford to upgrade pretty significantly. It was a pretty shocking spell in the match that sort of defined it. And Ollie Watkins, who scored twice in this game, he comes out afterwards, makes some interesting comments about Villa not having the mentality of a big team yet to kill off these games. I don't know how to quantify that kind of stuff, but it is an interesting talking point that their best player, their top scorer, feels that is an issue. So there is a question around Aston Villa between now and the end of the season, certainly if they're going to build into next season. But as I say, I think they're probably going to be safe enough for that fifth place spot.
All right, so a team who probably won't be getting European competition next year, Chelsea, which Joe mentioned before the break. What do we do with these guys? A 2-2 draw against Sheffield United. 1 minute, it's a thriller against Man United. The next, it's a tie against the worst team in the league. Chelsea, boy. Anyway, let's move on, shall we, to Spain. The Copa del Rey final. Athletic Club with a 1-1 draw against Mallorca, which ended in a penalty shootout victory for Bilbao. Their 24th Copa del Rey crown, Graham, but also their first trophy in 40 years. I had to double take. I couldn't believe this. 1984, when they actually won the league and the cup in 1984. But that is a drought that has ended. The game ended itself in Seville at 12:51 a.m. local time, which, once again, Spain going to Spain.
But that's early for Spain.
Yeah.
Everyone left and went and had their dinner after this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it was lunchtime after that. And then the scenes, Graham, from San Mamés, the opposite end of the country to Seville, in the north of Spain. Yeah. A sold-out stadium in Bilbao watching this game. It looked tremendous there.
Yeah, the scenes all the way around this match at San Mamés and at La Cartuja as well in Seville, where this game was played, were incredible. So as you say, Ryan, Athletic Club chasing their first trophy in 40 years. Mallorca, a team that don't usually get to this sort of stage, a huge occasion for them. So either way, it would have been a brilliant story. As it was Athletic who won the shootout in the end. And there were just so many remarkable sights. The two Williams brothers in tears together, two boyhood Athletic fans who have come through that system. As you say, Ryan, San Mamés sold out to watch the match on big screens. Old men crying because they hadn't seen this sort of thing for decades. Ernesto Valverde holding the Copa del Rey aloft as the man who's brought the good times back to Athletic Club. That decision by Barcelona to sack him while they were defending champions and top of La Liga is looking worse and worse. This was a huge club with a real connection to its fans and its community exercising some demons. And as I say, those scenes were incredible. Traditionally, when Athletic Club wins something, which as you've outlined, Ryan, doesn't happen very often, they have a boat parade through the city. So that apparently will be happening on Thursday, and I bet that is an amazing sight. I saw a video on social media of them getting the big barge ready for that parade, which all the players will be standing on, so keep an eye out for that. And see this narrative that we get sucked into as fans about cup competitions being lesser trophies, and we, I'm talking for myself here, I definitely get sucked into that narrative. But then you see things like this and the way that this was celebrated, what this means to a giant club like Athletic Club. You know, this is the counter to that point. These competitions still matter. In terms of the game itself, we didn't really see a great game, to be honest. We certainly didn't see the best of Athletic as a team. Mallorca were more organised in the first half. They were executing their game plan better. They were moving the ball more quickly when they won it back. Athletic, on the other hand, were really lacking ideas. They were panicked in some of their defensive moments. They fell behind when Dani Rodriguez scores after 21 minutes. A really nice finish, by the way, because it's so precise. There's about 20 players in the box, and he just composes himself for a second before picking out the corner. But in the second half, Athletic looked more like their usual selves. Sanset equalises after 5 minutes in the second half. Nico Williams was a constant threat. He had a lovely goal disallowed in the second half. It's his reverse pass for the equaliser. Athletic, after that, they moved the ball much more quickly, much more effectively. After a while, though, you got the sense that both teams were preparing for the shootout, and that's where Berenguer scores the winning penalty. So it wasn't the most exhilarating of matches, but you could feel the importance, the weight of the occasion on both teams throughout, and that made it a really tense watch.
Yeah, congratulations to Athletic Club for that. I've said it before on this feed, I said it again, they're a wonderful team and a really great city. If you are a soccer fan, you should visit there. It's like Newcastle in that it's a one-club town, is Bilbao. Just a really nice place to visit as well. I'd like to see that boat parade going past the Guggenheim. Frank Gehry original, Graham. It's wonderful.
Oh, the culture. The culture, Ryan.
Yeah, yeah. Incredible stuff. Well done to Athletic Club once again. Not so well done to Bayern Munich,
yes.
Joe, who had a 3-2 defeat at Heidenheim this past weekend. They blew a 2-0 lead. They've lost their sixth league game of the season. First time they've lost more than five games since 2011-2012, I should say. And it looks like the title race could be wrapped up next weekend.
Yeah, this thing's been done for probably over a month now. In reality, mathematically, Ryan, you're absolutely right about all of that. It really sunk in for me yet again, and I'm sorry to do it to him, just how funny it is that Harry Kane goes to the dominant team in Germany. Maybe along with PSG, so maybe the second most predictable title race typically in the major European leagues, and is going to end up maybe not in second, fellas, certainly not in first, maybe in third with Bayern Munich. Stuttgart and Bayern are level on points right now. Stuttgart beat Borussia Dortmund over the weekend. This is just pure insanity. And this game against Heidenheim was also pure insanity. Bayern up 2-0 at halftime. Coming into the second half, Heidenheim scored two goals in 2 minutes. They score in the 50th minute and the 51st minute, getting behind Bayern's backline both times. The first is more of a traditional vertical sort of moment. And the second one, there's a bit of distribution from the left side. Like, I just honestly do not understand how this has gone so poorly for Bayern throughout this season. But one thing that we've talked about before, and that I think is even more real now, is that the league basically doesn't matter for Bayern between now and the end of the season. They are not going to win the title. They will probably still finish second, but I'm not entirely sure about that. They won't end up lower than third. The Champions League is the only way to rescue this season. And even that, it won't totally rescue, right? They have been embarrassed by Bayer Leverkusen throughout the course of this season. But the Champions League and winning that competition is really the only way to end this season with something of a solid-ish taste in your mouth. Tuchel's gone either way. Bayern will have real changes in the offseason regardless. But man, the Bundesliga's gotten away from him, huh? Seems that way.
How about that? Yeah. First non-Bayern winner since 2012 we're going to get, Graham. Exciting stuff in the Bundesliga. Can I just say, Graham, Heidenheim Stadium, I think it's called the Voigt Arena. I looked it up. It was expanded to 15,000 relatively recently. It's got that Bournemouth/Southampton's old stadium, yeah. The Dell vibe about it. It looks
amazing.
Do you
know amazing. What it is? If anyone has ever played FIFA and you can select the lower league ground to play at, that's Heidenheim Stadium.
Yeah, I loved it. Just seeing that in the sunshine and Bayern getting beaten by some defensive frailty. It just looked great. It made me want to be there, frankly. But yeah, Bayern Munich probably did not want to be there. Bayer Leverkusen, Graham, with a 1-0 win at Union Berlin this weekend. Florian Wirtz with the goal there. They've equaled a league record of 28 games unbeaten this season. They're unbeaten in 41 games across all competitions. Leverkusen, they good.
Yeah, the Leverkusen tag is no more. Not officially, of course, but if Bayern lose on... Let me get these permutations right. If Bayern lose on Saturday, or if Leverkusen match their result on Sunday, it will be official. So if Leverkusen win on Sunday, they are champions. And what you mentioned there, Ryan, about 28 games unbeaten in the league, that's where the narrative is going to shift to in the Bundesliga with this team, is the potential of an unbeaten season, which would be an incredible achievement. Already an incredible achievement that they're going to win the title. But to go unbeaten this season would be utterly remarkable. In this game, it's Florian Wirtz who scores the winner from the spot. Against Union Berlin, I should mention, after what was a complete stramash towards the end of the first half. First, it's Robin Gosens who sent off for a tackle on Nathan Teller. Then from the resulting free kick, there was a scramble in the box. Players are on the ground, shots are rebounding everywhere, and Leverkusen ultimately bundle it into the net. But then VAR is used to spot a handball by Union Berlin player. The penalty is given, and Wirtz scores it. So Leverkusen have certainly had prettier wins, but they're so close now they can nearly touch it.
They are so close indeed. 16 points between these two teams, Bayern and Leverkusen, I should say, with 6 matches remaining. As you say, Graham, could be wrapped up next weekend. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, a couple of derbies to talk about in Rome and Glasgow. We've got MLS, we've got Sheep Leaves Cup, much more coming shortly.
This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs, who would like to remind you, when you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. You don't want to end up with Ryan, Graham, and Joe. Just kidding. Just kidding. Very much just kidding. Because I was very fortunate to have the three of them all join the show. And I had existing relationships with all three of them that allowed me to know that they could handle the amount of work that would be required, that they could be diligent in their tasks and be very effective on mic. And all three of them are. But again, that's because you have the existing relationship. If you don't feel like you have that with potential hires, then LinkedIn is going to make it very, very easy, and they're going to make it feel like you're connected to that person. They have a vast network of more than 1 billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire because it gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else. But when you are setting the requirements and making it very specific as to what you're looking for, you can very quickly narrow it down to find the right candidate for that position. Hiring is easy when you have that many candidates, so easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. And LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring, and you can too. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/TSS. That's linkedin.com/TSS to post your job for free. Terms and conditions do apply. Thank you very much to LinkedIn for sponsoring today's episode.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to the weekend review. We go to Rome and the Stadio Olimpico, where Roma had a 1-0 win over Lazio. Daniele De Rossi winning his first derby as boss of Roma. The first win in this match for Roma since 2022. Lazio have won 3 of the last 4. It was Gianluca Mancini with a goal from a Paolo Dybala corner. Graham, some interesting scenes with Gianluca Mancini after the game, waving a flag running around the track of the Olimpico. The flag depicting Lazio fans as rats. He's got in a bit of trouble.
Subtle.
With that one. Slightly unsubtle, but nothing less than you expect from the pure vitriol of this derby.
Yeah, there was some great poop housery in this match. I loved how very quickly it went from Paulo Dybala during the game showing Matteo Guendouzi his shin guard, where he has, somewhat bizarrely actually, but nonetheless, he has a picture of Argentina winning the World Cup, obviously Guendouzi being a Frenchman. So there's some subtle trolling going on there. Very quickly switch to Mancini running around at full time with the rat flag that has the Lazio's colours on it. So derby shenanigans, you can't beat it. I kind of enjoyed this match more for the poop housery than the game itself. I didn't think it was a great performance by Roma. It was sort of a match of moments, and Lazio did have quite a bit of the ball but weren't really able to do much with it. And as the second half progressed, Roma were playing on the break, which is how they create the El Shaarawy chance. He smacks off the inside of the post, which would have killed it off. They were certainly the more proactive team. They created more, posed a greater threat, and are now just 3 points behind Bologna, who drew against Frosinone. So top four is very much on for Roma, and the De Rossi hype train shows no sign of slowing down. It's remarkable how Roma have become. I don't think this game was a great illustration of how they've changed under De Rossi, but broadly speaking, they have become this high-energy team that actually wants to play football as soon as Jose Mourinho departed that club, almost as if he was holding them back or something. As you mentioned, Ryan, Roma hadn't beaten Lazio for 2 years. Mourinho lost four of his six Rome derbies, and it was a defeat in the Coppa Italia to Lazio earlier in the season that prompted Roma to sack Mourinho. So there was something cathartic to this win, and you can sense the energy around this club, and they really believe that they can snatch that last top four place and qualify for the Champions League, which was famously the ambition, the aim for Mourinho in his entire time at Roma, and he wasn't able to do it in three seasons. So quite ironic that the interim manager who replaced him might be the guy to pull that off.
Yeah, and from experience of living in Rome, this derby is vitriolic, as I said earlier. Like the atmosphere around and in the stadium for these games is like nothing else, despite the people of the both teams very much sharing the city. It's quite intense.
Did you take your rat flag to the game when you went, Ryan? Your Lazio rat flag. Rat flags.
I took my formal rat flag, Graham. It was my nicest one I brought for that one.
All right, fancy.
I know. Milan with a 3-0 win over Lecce. Christian Pulisic with the opener here. Lovely curling effort from outside the box. His left foot as well, Joe.
Very nice. Close personal friend of Ryan Bailey's, Christian Pulisic.
Yep.
Basically your godson. Ryan, I'm overjoyed. I'm overjoyed by all this. Pulisic has had an excellent season. I hope some of this form translates to the summer. But man, Milan sort of keep on chugging, and Pulisic has been a really, really big part of that. They're currently second in the league.
Yeah, doing very well. Stupid Sexy Giroud and Rafael Leao with the other two goals for Milan. Graham, you've put Juve's 1-0 win over Fiorentina on the running order. I'm not sure why.
I watched this match live on Sunday night because apparently I hate myself, and watching Allegri ball is my form of self-harm. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure why I watched this game. I think it was because there was nothing else on that really took my fancy. The first half actually wasn't bad from Juventus. The background of this match was that the Italian press said before kickoff that Allegri had the next two games to save himself, although some newspapers say he's doomed either way, and Thiago Motta, the Bologna manager, has been lined up already. But the first half was decent. There was energy about their build-up play. They were getting Chiesa on the ball, creating chances for Vlahovic, who looked sharp. Wes McKennie had a very nice assist for a disallowed goal, which was unfortunate for him. He was just offside, but it's a nice knockdown from a ball to the back post, and Vlahovic finished. And then at the other end, Fiorentina were being limited pretty well. They posed no real threat. But then as the match progressed, we saw Allegri ball return and Juventus essentially shut up shop. They ground it out at 1-0, which of course was a hallmark of Allegri ball when it worked for Juventus. But even when it does work, like it did in this game, I get the sense that this club is ready for a change. They are ready to step into 2024 with a new manager. So I expect finally there will be a change in Turin this summer.
Yeah, the rumours swelling this weekend, Graham. I saw Thiago Motta being lined up potentially for Juventus. So maybe some ground-out 1-0s won't be the future in 2024 and beyond for the old lady. Talking of old, how about the old firm, Graham? Bit of a roller coaster. Rangers and Celtic with a 3-3 draw. Rabbi Matondo with a stoppage time equaliser in the 94th minute. Rangers coming from behind twice in this one. It's actually a title race in that league where only two teams ever win it, Graham.
Well, recently it's only really been only one team that has won it. I gave this one the big build-up when you weren't here. Ryan Taylor let me speak about Scottish football. Thankfully, it didn't disappoint. This was the biggest Old Firm derby in over a decade in terms of the stakes. There will be an even bigger one in about a month's time when they play each other again. But nonetheless, this was the biggest one so far in about 13 years. And it was probably the most dramatic and entertaining too. Right from the first minute, it was a complete madness. Celtic scored after 19 seconds when Daizen Maeda sort of like tackled the ball into the goal from 20 yards, a complete freak goal. Quite fitting that the first goal in an Old Firm derby, given the nature of this match, would be a tackle. Then it went 2-0, and Rangers sort of looked dead and buried at that point, but they fought back to 2-2. There was a disallowed goal. Then seconds after the equaliser, Celtic went on the other end and made it 3-2, only for Rabi Matondo, as you say, Ryan, to curl a wonderful stoppage time equaliser into the top corner from outside the box to make
Shader-esque.
It was, yeah, it was a very nice finish. It was breathless stuff. And someone in the Discord asked me if the whole when the match was happening, if the whole match would be a sprint. I'm not entirely sure if this was the first Old Firm game that they had watched. I answered yes. There's only one other match, I think, in world football that is like the Old Firm derby in terms of how players just run at each other for 90 minutes. That other game is the Superclásico, by the way. I think it's very similar in that regard. It was incredible drama, and for the neutral, I think this is the best outcome because it keeps it so tight between these two teams, just a single point between Celtic at the top and Rangers in second. These teams are both very flawed, so Rangers have Dundee on Wednesday night. It would not surprise me if they end up dropping points in that game. It would not surprise me at all. In fact, I expect it that Celtic will drop points to lesser teams between now and the end of the season. So we've waited a long time for any sort of title race in Scotland, and it feels like we've finally got a good one here.
Very good, Graham. And another derby game in Scotland we'll talk about on our Patreon feed, because there's one that I believe you may have been attending, Graham.
Do we have to talk about that one?
Great. Let's not. Joe Lowry's MLS Corner. Another derby to talk about. El Tráfico this weekend. Tell us about it.
Wow, 2-1 win for LAFC over the LA Galaxy. Not one of the El Tráficos that I think will go down in the history of this rivalry, one that has, and I know Seattle and Portland fans aren't going to like this. I know there's probably a few other teams that aren't going to like this. This is the best and most entertaining, at least for the neutral, rivalry in Major League Soccer. LAFC, the better team. They get on the board early from a Tim Tillman goal off of a well-worked set piece. And then the Galaxy, off of Aude's nice finish after like four attempted shots inside the box, gets the Galaxy back in the game, and then Denny Bouanga scores what was a really, really tight penalty call that I think LAFC are a bit fortunate went their way in that first half. There was not a lot in that challenge from Mickey Amane, but Denny Bouanga makes them pay. LAFC at that point, the whole game set up in their favor, right? Under Steve Cherundolo, this version of LAFC, they don't really feel the need to have the ball. Like they're happy to have it from time to time, and they're happy to go and knife in behind and all that stuff. But they are much happier setting up defensively in their 4-3-3 shape, winning the ball somewhere in midfield and going out and attacking on the break. And they did a bunch of that in this game. They ended up dominating those transition moments. The Galaxy had Edwin Cerrillo, usually a number six, playing in the middle of the back line. They're really hurting for fit, healthy, or quality center backs. Really, any of those would do quite nicely for them. They just signed a young Colombian center back, as we talked about at some point last week. So there are some changes happening there, but man, LAFC knifed in behind over and over and over again. They didn't end up actually getting on the board in the second half, but that 2-1 lead from the first 45 minutes was more than enough for them. LAFC are still a really, really good team. Are they consistent? No. And that is what stops them from being a great team right now. Steve Cherundolo and John Thorrington and everybody else at that club will be hoping that their summer moves, and I don't expect them to make any big moves until the summer, that their summer moves will be enough to give them that little bit of consistency that makes them great. Right now, though, they are good. They are a threat in the Western Conference. And for the Galaxy, there wasn't a ton of pressure on them in this game, if I'm being totally honest. Yeah, they were above LAFC in the table over in the Western Conference. They had been one of the best teams out West. But I think everybody still has this feeling with the Galaxy that it's one transfer window, maybe one season too soon for them. They're still second in the West, but they need that center back that I mentioned earlier. They just straight up cannot control the opposition's transition attacks without like one more quality piece in their back line. There's still some tactical stuff for them to work on as well, but a missed opportunity this was regardless, right? Because they had a chance to establish themselves as the team in the West, not the supporter shield contending team, because I think those teams are all in the Eastern Conference, but a bit of a missed opportunity, even with the Galaxy sort of getting a free hit here. LAFC though, proving that they are still, as of now, as they were last season, the best team in the LA general area.
All right. Messi returning from injury and getting a goal and setting up a goal as well, or helping to set up a goal, I should say. Joe with a 2-2 draw against the Rapids. That leaves New York Red Bulls at the top of the East.
Yeah, very much so. Messi's angry right now. He had some words for Monterrey after their CCC game in the middle of last week.
Their manager had some words for him.
Yes, he did. Absolutely. And it seems like a lot of Messi's anger was tied to some of the comments made by Monterrey prior to that CCC game in the press. So we will see Messi back on the field for Inter Miami. We will see an angry Messi back on the field probably from the start in CCC as Miami try to reverse that 2-1 deficit that they had down in Fort Lauderdale. Yes, they end up drawing 2-2 with the Colorado Rapids. Not a ton that I feel the need to dig into in that game. But Ryan, you led me to the Red Bulls, who beat FC Cincinnati 2-1 over the weekend. This was a rematch of that playoff game that we had a couple of years ago in the first round of the Eastern Conference postseason. The Red Bulls are really, really good right now. Sandro Schwartz has done a lot of good work with this team, and they've done a great job of actually like putting competent players on the field together. Emil Forsberg looks like the real deal. He picks up a somewhat fortunate assist in this game and a 2-1 win for the Red Bulls. Cincinnati, for their part, still very much trying to find themselves. A bunch of new starters for Pat Noonan this year. We saw Yuya Kubo, former Bundesliga player, brought in as a DP several years ago. So supposed to be this like attacking goal scorer type. Ended up playing all the way back in defensive midfield. Is playing at both wingback spots this year. He was playing as sort of a second striker next to Aaron Bupenza. Since they are still trying to figure out exactly what their best 11 looks like and how to unlock Bupenza, who is very, very, very talented, but just hasn't quite found his top form this year as the pieces around him haven't been settled. That's still a work in progress for Cincinnati, who are a good team, but are still not quite a great team. Very quickly, I want to go look at the Western Conference. The Seattle Sounders get their first win of the season, and they do it in style. They absolutely jack stomp CF Montreal 5-0 at home. This felt like a release for the Sounders, who have been just waiting to finally put up 3 points on the board this season. They've dealt with injury after injury after injury. They're finally getting closer to being healthy. They're still not all the way there yet. Pedro de la Vega still out. Leo Chu out. Nuhu leaves this game in the first half. Jao Paulo doesn't start this match. There are still concerns for them. But man, this looked much more like the Seattle team that we expected to see. Some pretty possession play, some good work in the counter press. A lot of things that Brian Schmetzer should take as positives in this game. And then a couple of other very, very quick results over in the Western Conference. Austin FC, San Jose, 7 goals in this game. Austin ended up winning this thing 4-3 after being down 2-0. Sebastian Giriussi looks like he's back to being one of the best players in Major League Soccer. He has been exceptional since his return from injury. Vancouver top Toronto FC 4-0, and they are now a real threat in the Western Conference. And then we had a 3-3 game between Sporting Kansas City and the Portland Timbers. That game was on Sunday. It was a lone Sunday game. SKC up 3-0 by halftime. And Portland scored 3 goals in the second half to make this thing 3-3. The Western Conference, I don't know if there are any truly great teams, but I do know there's plenty of chaos. And for the neutral, that is oftentimes good enough.
Joe, one storyline you didn't touch on there is Cucho Hernandez.
Mm.
What's the deal? What's going on with Cucho this season? There's some weird stuff going on there.
All right, here's the deal. So Cucho Hernandez, and from what I understand, after the Crew had their game against Charlotte FC, Ryan, I'm assuming this is somehow your fault and that you caused this outburst, Cucho was irritated. I think he wanted to be taken off and wasn't fast enough for his liking. There was some issue there with the substitution timing in the second half against Charlotte. He throws a bit of a fit, and Wilfred Nancy disciplines him within the team and doesn't really share the reasoning with the public, and that's his prerogative. But he ends up being suspended internally for 2 games, so we don't see him in the CCC clash against Tigres, and we didn't see him in the regular season. He was back this weekend against DC United in a 1-1 draw for the Columbus Crew, and then gets a red card immediately. So he will be out for the next regular season game for the Columbus Crew. Was sort of baited into like lashing out by DC in this game. I would imagine that we'll see him in the starting lineup for Columbus against Tigres, because otherwise it's going to be 2 more games before we see him on the field for Columbus. Yeah, things are not great for the Crew right now. Even still, they're a really, really good team, but things aren't going awesome.
Well, that was going to be my next question, Joe. Obviously, we've spoken at length about the Crew and the work that Wilfred Nancy has done. But let's just say we project out from now and Cucho Hernandez flames out at the Crew and he's gone by the summer, right? How does that change the equation for them this season?
I think it probably takes the shield off the table and it makes winning any trophy so much more difficult. What distinguishes the Crew from all the other, from most of the other great teams in MLS, there may be a few teams that are really close to them, is not only do they have the incredibly solid tactical foundation where everybody's on the same page, they're able to squeeze a few extra drops out of the lemon, right? Like they can do a little bit more, but they also have the top-end talent. They also have Cucho Hernandez, who is, along with maybe Messi in terms of like impact in this league, Messi's able to do more, obviously. But Cucho's probably the next guy down in that tier. Like when you lose him, you lose an MVP candidate. When you lose him, you lose that last piece that's going to put you over the top in basically any trophy conversation. And you probably can't go out there and find someone as good as Cucho. So I don't think this is going to be a real issue. I don't think this hypothetical will turn into reality. But if you're looking at ways to topple the Columbus Crew, having just straight up chaos, along with a bit of an injury crisis for them as well, by the way, having Cucho Hernandez sort of spiral is probably the best way outside of, or maybe even slightly ahead of, Wilfred Nancy leaving in the summer or leaving in the winter or whatever it is. Things need to stabilize in Columbus. I think they will at this point. I think Wilfred Nancy has done enough for folks to probably need to trust his management approach at the moment. But man, things are a bit rocky in Columbus and probably rockier than anybody expected them to be.
Plenty more MLS chat on the feed and Tuesday's show upcoming, of course. Joe, before we leave the American soccer landscape, USL now on CBS, yeah. A new era for the league, now on network TV.
Yeah, this was a really, really cool moment. On Saturday at 4 p.m. Eastern, Louisville City top Indy 11 5-3 in one of the great rivalries in the United Soccer League. This game was awesome, but it wasn't really about the game for the USL on Saturday. It obviously helped that they had a barn burner. Like, that was a really, really nice thing for the league. But to have a game on CBS, to have a game that's available to literally everyone, Ryan, you said it, network TV, that's a first for the USL, first for the championship, first for League One. This has never happened before. This is part of the new broadcast deal that they've got with CBS. ESPN's still in the picture as well, but CBS and the strides that they're taking, frankly, on the soccer side, they're doing more than anybody else in American soccer right now to continue to push forward, building a bunch of stuff out of their initial Champions League coverage. They committed to this game. They had Mike Watts and Devin Kerr there. They had Heather Mitz there on the sideline. They had Alexis Guerreros coming in to do like coverage around the game in the lead up for their various shows on Golazo. And then the game was absolutely fantastic at Lynn Family Stadium. It's a stadium that looks good on TV. The atmosphere, I thought, came across really, really well, certainly from the supporter section. They clearly committed to the broadcast with different camera angles and mic placements and all that stuff. Like, CBS went for it, and I don't know what the broadcast numbers are. I don't believe the league has heard what the official ratings were from this game. But man, as far as an advertisement for soccer in general, having 8 goals in a game on Saturday afternoon over, like, you know, free-to-watch TV, it's pretty hard to beat that.
That is pretty awesome indeed, Joe. As is some news from the Sheep Leafs Cup. The USA with a 2-1 win over Japan this weekend. Lindsay Horan with a 77th-minute penalty to give the US the win and send them to the final, which I believe, Joe, is taking place on Tuesday in Columbus against Canada.
Columbus just popping up all over American soccer right now. Graham, do you second my motion to ban Ryan from saying Lindsay Horan's name? Say yes or aye.
Yes.
Okay, great.
I signed most petitions for Ryan to
be banned from
stop
stuff.
Most words.
Oh, okay, yeah. Perfect. Lindsay Horan does get on the board here. Jaden Shaw is the truth, and I told you all. That is my top line take from this game. I've been hyping up Jaden Shaw for more than a year now. She is absolutely incredible. And the little drone shot that Atlanta United, this happened at Atlanta United Stadium, Mercedes-Benz. The drone shot, or the high angle shot, whatever it is, that Atlanta have in that stadium. We saw it on a Thiago Almada, and I think Georgios Giakoumakis' goal earlier this season, and we see it on this Jaden Shaw goal. It makes it look like it's straight out of FIFA, or I guess EAFC now. Go find that clip somewhere on the USWNT's Twitter account. It is absolutely incredible. It looks like it's straight out of a video game. As is Jaden Shaw, because she is so unbelievably good. Japan scored in the first minute of this match. Shaw gets equalizer in the 21st. The U.S. in general were, I thought, the pretty clearly superior team in this game. Shaw is a difference maker. Alex Morgan got involved. But maybe the top line thing for the U.S. out of this game, Mallory Swanson is back, and she looks angry and happy to be on the field at the exact same time. She almost didn't put a foot wrong in her first game for the U.S. She misses the World Cup last summer after suffering an injury in a game back in April, I believe, against Ireland. It was really, really good to see her back on the wing for the United States. She looked excellent, and the U.S. did a lot of really, really good things in this game. They'll play that final against Canada, Ryan, as you mentioned, tomorrow in Columbus.
Wonderful stuff. I'll sign your petition that I'll never say Linze Horan, or however I pronounced it.
Excellent. You got the last name right somehow on this time, right?
All right, there's been plenty of weekend to review. We've got plenty more. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show for a little bit extra, including the Dutch Classica, including the madness of the Turkish Super Cup. There's a great story there. Maybe we'll even touch on that story of what the Monterrey coach said about Leo Messi in our bonus feed as well. But for now, we have reviewed the weekend. Joe Lowry, thank you very much for your help in doing so.
Thank you, darling.
Graham Ruthven, pleasure as always.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey.
Listener, thank you for joining us on the feed. We'll be back very shortly, but for now, bye!